From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. No law has been passed, no specific directives issued, and yet as many as 25,000 private security contractors are being paid by the U.S. government to provide a wide range of military services in Iraq. In the cover story for the New York Times magazine last week, Daniel Bergner reported on what he called the other army, and he joins me now. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thanks. It's great to be back on.
Approximately how many private soldiers are there in Iraq?
We're talking about 25,000. That includes Iraqis who are working for these Western private security companies. But the important thing to stress is we don't fully know the answer to your question because no one is really keeping track of the numbers, the dollars spent, what these companies are doing.
So it could be less and it could be more. But what kind of ratio to the real military troops in Iraq can we guess at?
Well, we're talking about an additional 15-16% to the coalition troops. So it's a significant addition to our soldiering force there in Iraq.
Is there a similar situation in Afghanistan?
No, it doesn't seem so. Again, it's no one's fully keeping track, so I can't give you a definitive answer. But Iraq has been a very special and transformative case. We were, before then, using private security guys in very, very limited numbers. And when we wanted to protect President Karzai early on in Afghanistan, we had a detail of about 40 men there. So we're talking about a complete transformation when we're up toward 25,000.
Is this something that we've had in other wars as well? After all, mercenaries go back throughout history. Were there private, whatever words we want to call them, private soldiers in the first Gulf War? What about Vietnam or Grenada or Panama or any of the other wars that we've been engaged in?
It's a really good question, and the basic answer is no. However, there were in support roles, in unarmed support roles, certainly guys going back to Vietnam, probably to a certain degree in the first Gulf War. And then, as you know, there was around the time of the first Gulf War, in the early 90s, there was a great emphasis that began to be placed on using private companies to do the support roles for the Army. That is everything from washing dishes to servicing warplanes. Some of those roles were very, very crucial, but the huge change here is that we're talking about armed men and armed men who've been involved in battle and are quite constantly, even now, embattled in Iraq.
Didn't the Geneva Convention ban the use of mercenaries? That was 1949, wasn't it?
Yep. In international conflicts between nations, the private soldiering was not granted combatant status by those Geneva Conventions. So, yes, it was effectively outlawed. But here we're in this gray area in all kinds of senses, but one of them is whether these guys are actually fully soldiers or not. Now, I think it's clear that they are, but in spite of one difference, they aren't performing offensive operations. That is, they're not going out looking for the enemy and looking to kill or looking to take over territory. But because they're in such crucial defensive roles, they're involved in full-on battles, taking mortar fire, rocket-propelled grenades, etc., being involved in battles that last a day or longer, defending during that first year of our occupation the CPA headquarters, that is the headquarters of our occupation authority. So they really are performing an essential military role, and there aren't too many people who would argue otherwise. In fact, I spoke to General Jay Gardner, who is the original occupation authority head there in Iraq, and his response was, of course, these guys are performing a military function.
But officially, they're working as kind of bodyguards. You say that they don't like the word mercenary, and the companies involved don't even want to be called private military. They prefer private security.
Right. And it sort of has to do with a kind of evolution of terminology here. Of course, no one wants to be associated with the kind of old caricatured, roguish image of the mercenary, just sort of ruthlessly, in a predatory way, stirring up trouble.
But wait, haven't we seen mercenaries in a lot of the civil wars that have taken place over the last 20 or 30 years? Are they being called private security now? In Sierra Leone, for example, in Liberia?
It's a good question. I guess we should back up and say, and we talked a little bit about this the last time I was on your show, because I spent a good deal of time in West Africa, in Sierra Leone, and there's sort of a pivot point. This is going back to the mid-90s. A company called Executive Outcomes came in, and their performing offensive operations managed to drive out a very, very brutal rebel force, and so began to change public perception of these companies, and people began to see that they could perform a positive role. And it's that transformation, that pivot point, that in part sets the stage for what's happened now in Iraq. But, and it's important to stress this, no one, even after those interventions of the mid-90s, was completely comfortable with private soldiering and with hiring out armed men. And so now the companies have taken on this new term, private security company, as a way to make the work seem more palatable, more acceptable to everyone.
And has anybody accepted this rebranding?
The companies themselves certainly urge it upon the public. I don't think anyone can realistically, at least in the context of Iraq, at least where you're talking about an intense war zone like that, no one can really credit it because the companies are so embattled there and so constantly, you know, in any given week, they are on the receiving end of complex ambushes from the insurgency and are being forced to fire back to defend themselves, defend their clients, defend the sites that they're protecting.
I'm talking to Daniel Bergner, whose article, The Other Army, appeared in the Sunday Times Magazine a week ago, not yesterday. You wrote the article when the Coalition Provisional Administration was running Iraq. Who's contracting these companies now?
Right. As the coalition provisional authority there was phased out, and as the State Department became our representatives, and as we turned over sovereignty to the Iraqis, there was a change. The State Department is hiring the companies. Our military, the Department of Defense itself, is hiring them. And here's sort of a curiosity, but a striking one. Four U.S. generals currently in Iraq are being protected by the companies.
I mean, rather than by their own soldiers?
Correct. And interestingly enough, and sort of add a little bit of humor to the situation, at least the last time I checked a few weeks ago, those four U.S. generals were actually being protected by British private security companies. So it's that end. It's the military. It's the State Department. And then, of course, it's the companies that are carrying out the reconstruction that are relying on these companies, private security companies, to protect them.
Well, there already were British companies in place when this happened. But a lot of the people who are doing this work seem to have come from apartheid-era South Africa, the defense force there, or from the army of General Pinochet in Chile. Should we be concerned that these people who have been engaged in atrocities against their fellow countrymen are now out there trying to keep the peace in Iraq?
Well, you know, as you know from our discussions about West Africa, there are guys who have very troubling apartheid-era histories who now have performed quite admirably elsewhere. And, you know, I wrote about one in Sierra Leone who performed quite heroically. So I don't think we can write off those soldiers completely, but it's certainly one of the areas for concern. But sort of overarching that is, where does our Pentagon, our Department of Defense, come in or fail to come in terms of overseeing this whole sector of private gunmen on whom we're relying there in Iraq.
In your article, you focused on one particular private security company called Triple Canopy. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, they were a great story, and one of the reasons I got so involved with them is that they basically were started by two friends from our special forces who thought after 9/11 that they'd start a company, use their military backgrounds, their military specialties, to give training to other governments, to our government agencies in anti-terrorism techniques. But as middle of 2003 came along, and as our army in Iraq was desperate for a way to protect those CPA headquarters, they heard of this program to hire out private security. And so in a great hurry, they went from basically nothing, from just a name, to a company that was earning, you know, close to $200 million a year. So it's a huge turnaround and a very colorful one.
So they had no corporate goals until they began bidding on government contracts in Iraq, and that kind of defined what their company became.
They had corporate dreams. They had dreams of starting something big, but no particular way right away to do it. But there was this sudden and quite desperate need, and they met it. They began to hire their old colleagues from special operations, hired some very qualified guys. In spite of that, it was a very haphazard beginning. They needed, for instance, when they won the contracts, they had no armored vehicles in which to transport people around. They literally had to sort of scour our country and wound up with a set of armored vehicles that had gone from the Sultan of Brunei to being rented out by several rap stars. Triple Canopy gathered those together, shipped them off to Iraq, and basically got started in that kind of fashion.
Is that fairly typical of the companies we are engaging for private security in Iraq?
It's not untypical. I mean, there was a very sudden need and a sudden response. So while you had companies like Blackwater that had been quite established sort of 5-7 years previous, you also had several like Triple Canopy, which rose up with this very sudden need, this sudden boom market in Iraq. And it's, you know, in Triple Canopy's case, not to take away from their credentials. They definitely had them, and they've conducted themselves well there. But it was a very abrupt transformation.
In fact, they seem to have done better than a company like Blackwater, which has had some very terrible things happen to it.
You're right. I mean, Triple Canopy's record is pretty much spotless. They haven't had a client killed. They've had none of their own guys killed. It certainly was reassuring to me as I spent time with them over there. A company like Blackwater, and it's, you know, it's hard to know where responsibility lies for this, but they've had many guys killed. In fact, one of the first incidents that really called attention to this sector was, you remember that in April of 2004, they had four guys who were ambushed and brutalized and wound up hung from the Fallujah Bridge there, and they've had several many deaths since.
We will take a little break here, and then we'll come back with more of this discussion with Daniel Berkner, who wrote an article called The Other Army that was the cover story in last Sunday's, not this recent Sunday, but the previous Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Stay with us. We're back with Daniel Berkner, who wrote a cover story for the New York Times Magazine. On the cover, it said The New Soldiers of Fortune, and the article itself was called The Other Army. You say that at the beginning of the war, there weren't all of these private security people around. What has led the military to depend so much more on outside security over the course of this war?
Well, I think in the simplest terms, not enough troops on the ground. Pretty much everyone I spoke with, except, of course, high-level Pentagon officials, would acknowledge that. And then more specifically, I think particularly not enough infantry soldiers, not enough military police to carry out these security functions of protecting men and protecting physical sites there, government sites on the ground.
What did the Pentagon tell you?
Very, very little. They are apparently very reluctant to speak about this, and should give a little bit of history here. When those four Blackwater guys were killed at Fallujah, this whole issue began to receive some attention. And Congress asked for more information. Congress's appropriation bill to the military from 2004 demanded, in fact, some kind of accountability measures, some governance measures whereby the Pentagon would take control and would supervise and enforce that supervision over this sector. But the Pentagon just hasn't responded. It's way late in terms of getting that document into play, and it's very unclear from my calling around that there really will be responsibility taken and that there really will be enforcement measures taken by the U.S. military.
Did the military people who were willing to talk to you believe that private contractors can do certain jobs more effectively than our own army?
Unclear if the Pentagon itself believes that. Certainly other people do, and there is an argument to be made. That is, one, these companies can be a lot more flexible, one, in terms of the manpower they can commit and then remove from the field, depending on need. Two, in terms of if you're a U.S. official, say, there, and you need to get from meeting to meeting, from place to place, perhaps these guys can be a little more pliable, maybe even take a few more risks than a huge institution like the military would in order to allow you to interact with the Iraqi public there. So there is that argument to be made. But what's interesting to me is the Pentagon itself really isn't willing to make it. It's the Pentagon itself has spoken loudly about the advantages of outsourcing, that is, privatizing the support, the unarmed roles. But they don't seem to really want to be explicit in associating themselves with the armed private soldiers. And that's interesting to me. It says to me that they are still uncomfortable with this very sector that they've been so influential in employing.
Well, didn't the situation at Abu Ghraib make that discomfort even more obvious? Weren't private contractors involved there?
They were indeed. Now, those guys, to my knowledge, were not armed. We're again talking about the support side, but yes, that didn't help a bit. There were private contractors who were involved in those interrogations and brought a lot of problematic publicity.
And that was, they were the employees of a private security company called CACI?
Right.
What has happened to those people? Have they can't be court-martialed, obviously.
The whole legal aspect of this is, again, I hate to use the word two or three times, but it's a gray area. What legal authority and what enforcement mechanisms there are for these guys is very, very unclear. And people I spoke with, military lawyers, basically acknowledge that. We don't know who is covering these guys. And to bring it back over to the armed side, you know, when I spoke to military people off the record, their answer was, well, the context will be Iraqi sovereignty no matter what military edicts finally emerge. And that, to me, says we're leaving this to an infant government, the Iraqi government, which basically just can't assert authority over these well-armed men.
Are private contractors still engaged in the interrogation of detainees?
I don't know.
We did have an embarrassing situation in Afghanistan where a private company set up its own prison, but that has been resolved by allowing an Afghan court to try him.
Right. And the question in Iraq is there really an Iraqi judicial system that can do that? But let's take it a step back from even the sort of judicial level and the police level. One of the guys at Triple Canopy said very candidly to me, one, our Department of Defense just doesn't have the manpower to police us, that is, the private security companies. And if an Iraqi police squad were to stop me, I would never give up my guns to that squad. I would be afraid for my life because, of course, the Iraqi police are not yet, in the eyes of Westerners at least, a trustworthy entity. So you've got limited, if any, enforcement capability, and then a judicial system that, as far as I know, you know, scarcely exists, if it exists at all.
Don't some of these private companies employ Iraqis?
They do. They do with some trepidation. And in terms of the actual, what's called the security details, as opposed to the sort of protection of fixed sites, the protection of headquarters, it's my understanding that there are very few employers, that is, reconstruction companies or U.S. officials, who are comfortable using Iraqis to move them from place to place throughout the war zone.
Well, earlier this year, the New York Times Magazine ran a cover story on the Iraq War that compared it to the civil war in El Salvador and noted that the U.S. Army was relying increasingly on paramilitaries in the form of ex-Ba'athist soldiers, and they seemed to have been really gung-ho.
I do. I remember that story. It was a terrific story and very interesting, but I would say a limited applicability on the use of Iraqi police and Iraqi paramilitaries. And also there, if I'm remembering right, they were very closely overseen by American forces. And I think that there just isn't the comfort level yet, certainly not in the much more free-for-all area of the private sector, to rely on Iraqi security operators.
I'm talking with Daniel Bergner, who is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, the author of In the Land of Magic Soldiers, A Story of White and Black in West Africa. That's the book that brought him to our show about a year ago. And we are talking about an article he wrote for the New York Times Magazine called The Other Army. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how much is all of this costing us? Does outsourcing save taxpayers money?
It's costing us a lot, and again, we don't know. And that seems unbelievable that we wouldn't know how much is spent, but it is nevertheless the case. I'll give you an anecdotal example and then an example from a recent report to Congress. When I was calling into the Pentagon, and I mean that was daily over a period of weeks, you know, the answers were, we just don't know how much even we ourselves, that is the DOD itself, is spending in various ways on these private contractors, then broaden it out. How much are we spending in terms of the Hearts and Minds campaign of the war, the reconstruction effort? Recent report to Congress by the Government Accountability Office said, again, we just don't know. The different agencies aren't keeping track. It's certainly upwards of $1 billion. It's certain that those reconstruction companies are spending somewhere between, say, 15% and 30% in that area of their budgets on security. How much exactly, though, is unknown because we turn to this force so suddenly and we have failed to keep track of it.
How do pay and conditions of these private military contractors compare to that of the U.S. troops?
Of course, they're getting paid way more.
I assume that there's a certain amount of resentment.
There does seem to be some resentment, and there was this recent incident, one of the few examples of any kind of enforcement against one of the companies. There were a group of about 14 security guys for a company called Zapata, and they were detained by U.S. Marines for apparently shooting wildly both at civilians and, according to the Marines, at the Marines themselves. Marines held them for 3 days. The guys emerging from that detention claimed that the Marines roughed them up, humiliated them, treated them like they would insurgents, and taunted them over their salaries. So that is some indication of the kind of resentment because these guys are making about three times what their counterparts would be making in the U.S. military itself.
And I would assume that if I were a highly qualified officer about to leave the Army, I might look to this as a way of getting a lot more money doing what I already do.
Yeah, I mean, let's take the highest, the sort of elite sector of the U.S. military, a guy with about 15 years experience, and guy who's been through intensive training and intensive psychological testing, and is working at top level of special forces might be making about $55,000 a year. Now, he can go over to the private side and be making upwards of $100,000 a year, and a lot of that will be tax-free if he stays over in Iraq for much of a year. So, yeah, there's a huge temptation, and there's significant concern on the part of the commanders of those special forces sectors that they're going to lose their best men to the private side.
Let's get back to oversight. Are the private security contractors doing any screening? Do they have a screening process when they hire these people?
Very varied. On Triple Canopy side, one of the things that sort of surprised me and intrigued me, they not only put the guys through a long screening and training course, but they do these psychometric tests. So they're testing not only for intelligence, but sort of for stability. And actually, I had the privilege of taking one of these tests, and you know, it's fairly rigorous, and it was an indication that in some companies a fair amount of care is taken. But to go to the other extreme, there was a guy I spent a good deal of time with who'd worked alongside a convict, and this guy, performing private security work, well armed, light machine gun in hand, had recently been convicted of assault for nearly shooting an acquaintance's jaw off in a game of Russian roulette here in the state. So you've got a wide spectrum of guys and a wide spectrum in terms of how carefully their backgrounds are checked before they're sent over there.
Have any rules of engagement and accountability been set for these private contractors?
There are rules of engagement written, rules that basically talk about it, you know, escalating allowed self-defense. But how well they're followed is very unclear. And again, who would enforce the rules were they not followed? The answer seems to be no one. So there are things written, but largely things unfollowed. And a good example of that is the kind of weapons that can be used. There are rules in play about that, limited to light machine guns, and caliber of rounds are limited. But what's actually being used, for instance, those Zapata guys were caught with anti-tank weapons. So, you know, off the record, some of the companies are using some pretty significant weaponry.
And you said that Triple Canopy got a lot of its weaponry from the deposed Saddam Hussein regime. They couldn't buy stuff on the open market, so they simply went into the munitions dumps and took out what they thought they could use.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of that sort of rush early on, is that they couldn't get certificates, couldn't get end-user certificates to properly ship over U.S. arms to Iraq. So they just got DOD permission to go into those captured munition sites, cull what AK-47s were available, and go with that. You know, at the beginning they were also shipping over, you know, rucksacks full of $500,000 in cash in order to fund their operations. So we're very much talking about a huge economy, a $1 billion economy that has started in a sort of very colorful, sometimes haphazard way, and is just now becoming sort of routinized, and hopefully the Department of Defense will see that there is a real need to come in there and regulate this sector as well.
Well, hasn't the White House sought immunity from prosecution for U.S. contractors in Iraq?
Yes, it has, and that appears to be in place, though again, it's murky, and I would hesitate to comment. Some international lawyer is sure to be listening and able to correct me on it, but I can say with certainty that it is a murky area, whether they have complete immunity or partial immunity, or again, as I've said, the sort of effective immunity of there being very little, if any, enforcement.
Are any of these companies the equivalent of Halliburton?
Not really. It's important to sort of separate. Halliburton, which has received so much attention, really is devoting itself to the unarmed sector that we heard so much about as the war built up and that received so much discussion. And I think this side, the armed sector, really caught a lot of people, me included, by surprise. I mean, I was very aware of privatized soldiering during the mid-90s and as things built up to Iraq. But when I thought about whether I really believe that we would be arming private men in Iraq. My answer was no. So even I, you know, thinking about that 25,000 figure, am still taken aback that this is where we are.
Well, actually, the U.S. Army seems to be failing to meet its recruiting targets. We've seen a decline in domestic support for the war. So do you see the U.S. increasingly relying even more on private soldiers to fight the war as it goes on?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that as a lot of people expect, that as we begin to pull out troops, if we continue, nevertheless, to commit ourselves to the reconstruction side, that yes, there will have to be a further reliance on the private sector in order to provide protection for the rebuilding effort.
In your article, you note that there was some talk of the United Nations hiring private security firms to help with its peacekeeping operations. What happened with that?
Well, right, and that's talk that began again in the late 90s after that intervention in Sierra Leone that was in many ways so successful. And I would say there's something to that. I mean, the UN has not yet committed itself in that direction, but a lot of people think that, say, protecting a refugee camp within a war zone might well be done by these companies. And I think they may well be right. If the UN is willing to do what the Pentagon has not been, which is to govern and to oversee these guys carefully, I think that is a good use because the UN has had such difficulty offering protection, you know, creating any kind of order within the war zones of the world.
Why do you think that all of this has been allowed to continue without any real accounting? Isn't there anyone in Congress saying, how much is this actually costing us?
There are a few people in Congress who have been attending to this, but as you mentioned before, you know, when you brought up Halliburton, a lot more attention has gone to that just because the dollar figures there are so huge and because there have been such questions of financial accountability. I don't know why this hasn't received more attention, and at least in terms of the DOD's lack of accountability, a bit of outrage. I've been perplexed by that.
We have a caller who wants to know why we're even bothering with this discussion. There's a need. They're there. So why pursue it any further?
I agree there's a need. I agree they're there. But I certainly think we need to know more about this. We're talking about 25,000 armed guys in a country where really, there's no capability for accounting and for governing. So we need to take responsibility. After all, we went in there, we invaded, we occupied. Let's take the responsibility for having infused a war zone with 25,000 armed men.
What happens if there is a serious atrocity connected with one of these groups? Who will be held accountable, or is this something that will allow for deniability?
I think it could allow for deniability. It could allow for distancing from the administration from the event. And I think the scenario you just raised is really the answer to your caller's question. We can't simply privatize and then decide that privatization means we don't have anything to do with it. And in fairness, there are several companies, Triple Canopy among them, a couple of the British companies, that would really like to see closer government oversight. They feel like it would be good for business. They feel like it would remove that old mercenary taint. They're probably right. There's an argument to be made for privatization, but not if we aren't going to take responsibility.
Daniel Bergner's article, The Other Army, was the cover story in the August 14th edition of the New York Times Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard LoPate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.